remind you what the professor actually wrote in that heinous essay that's caused this firestorm. Again, he compared 9/11 victims to one of Hitler's henchmen, the one that, in fact, put the Holocaust on, planned the Holocaust. He also called the terrorists soldiers, and he wrote this about the Pentagon. He said, "The building and those inside compromised military targets, pure and simple. As to those in the World Trade Center, well, really, let's get a grip here, shall we? True enough, they were civilians of a sort, but innocent? Give me a break. They formed a technocratic core at the very heart of America's financial empire." Well, earlier today, I spoke to Governor Bill Owens about these statements, and I asked him if the Board of Regents would have the guts to fire Ward Churchill. This is what he said.
You know, Joe, in Colorado, the board is separately elected by the voters. It's not part of, for example, my administration. I don't believe they will. They have put the pressure on to remove him as chair of the department, but my guess is that the board will not, in fact, have the courage to force this issue through tenure and take away his position. Ward Churchill should have the right as an American to say whatever he wants, but as an employee of the University of Colorado, he shouldn't. But I'm afraid that we won't be able to see that happen given this board.
So, Governor, there will be no accountability then, will there? I mean, this guy steps down as head of his department, but he's still making close to $100,000. No accountability for comparing 9/11 victims to Adolf Eichmann.
Shut the hell up, John Scarborough, crying about Ward Churchill's little comment. Basically a comment he made 4 years ago. Now you just got your little punks all together to try to destroy the tenureship setup that's going on in the universities. Well, look, Scarborough, you are a little Eichmann. Your punks like O'Reilly are Eichmanns. And at the end of the day, you'll end up where all Eichmanns belong, the cemetery. Now try stepping to me about some censorship. You get a bullet right where it belongs. You know what time it is, slave time. Check. Listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, and in the blog sphere, just go into your Google web at Slave Revolt Radio and check out what we got going on, Slave Revolt time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment as it deals with a deal with the devil in the Sudan, the so-called peace deal. Then we're going to shoot our way into a shameless file on another so-called peace deal, if you ask Boy George, the elections in Iraq. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave. Revolt.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight what we're going to start off with is Sudan's peace deal. And what that really means in the real world. Is it really more or less a deal with just another capitalist devil? You know, recently the dictatorial government of Sudan in Khartoum signed a peace agreement with the southern region of the Sudan, where it has had a 20-year conflict. Over 2 million dead. The rebel force is led by the SPLA, people like John Garang, and they've had much conflict over the issues of self-determination and autonomy with the Khartoum government, which is basically an Islamic dictatorial government. We're going to examine what this peace deal is really all about, and some of its influences in brokering the so-called peace deal. So first up, here's Sally Booker. He's the director of African Action. And he talks about this current peace deal that is taking place. And let's check out what he has to say, and then let's us take it from there. Check it out.
It is a historic agreement, and it represents the southern struggle over so many decades to finally gain a measure of self-determination in this agreement over a period of time. The government is perhaps calculating that it had no choice but to sign this agreement in order to reduce some of its commitments to war in the south because of the ongoing genocide that it's conducting in the western part of the country. It's complicated in the sense that it's hard to celebrate given what's going on in western Sudan. And yet for southerners and for millions of Sudanese, this really is a historic agreement, an opportunity finally to end what has been the longest running war in the country and for the continent. It's not just the past two decades, but actually since independence in 1956, that this war between the North and the South has been going on. There's only been a decade of peace from the early 70s to the early 80s. And so it's a complicated agreement. It's ambitious. The question is, will it be implemented? Will it meet its timetable? Because if not, the South certainly will secede.
Now, what's kind of sick about what's going on is, see, basically, there's just a rush for gold, black gold, that's taking place. The Khartoum government and its little offshots that help implement its ideology, the NIF, National Islamic Front, they're just a little capital monarch regime that is not really concerned with human rights or peace. Basically, they're about privatization and expanding their power and using their hocus-pocus mysticism as a way of controlling much of the indigenous population. And the way you break people away from their historical connection to the land, their particular modes of production and ways of life, especially if it's not independent of the market system that you want them caught up in, is you basically break their cultural strains and their ways of living off of the ground, off of the environment, and then bring them in to your fold. Now, of course, many times these types of people are quite content with their particular way of life. So you set out a way to destroy them. Now, the reason why I mention this in part is because, see, like right now, while the main attention is on Darfur, in the Darfur region, which is in the western part of the Sudan, many of you people, you know, who've checked out the things I've done on the Sudan, like part one and part two, which you can check out on the Slave Revolt blog, know that they've also had this conflict going on in the southern part of the Sudan, but at the same time, they have a conflict that is really not in the focus of many people's attention right now in the Nuba Mountains. Now, currently, right now, and for years, they've been waging a genocidal campaign against the Nubas in the mountains. And you have a situation where these clowns have set up what they call peace camps. See, basically what happened was Niamey, this is back when he was in power before the 1989 coup by, you know, the little thugs, you know, Bashir, and who's now president, and some of these other clowns that are now in power, and the NIF got into power. Numeri proclaimed his kind of Shariat in 1983. Civil war started to break out once again in that region as people of the South saw their self-determination start to get undermined. And then it reached the Nuba Mountains by 1985. Well, what then started to happen was you had a situation where Chevron had discovered oil in the Bent area, which is in, you know, just south of the Nuba Mountains in 78. So they knew that vast reserves of oil were there. But the Nubas have always been independent. They didn't really need anyone from the outside or anything like that for their own self-sufficiency. So at that point, when the mixture of oil and all of this other stuff, which plays a part when you have dictatorial regimes wanting to usurp people from their land, they look for excuses to undermine the basic rights. And in this case, they just throw out this Islam claptrap stuff. So you've had a situation where a large-scale attack started to take place really seriously between 1991 and 93. The government declared a sacred war on all disbelievers, Christians, and quote-unquote wayward Muslims. And they planned an exile of all Nubas. This is when they put into focus what's called the soft grip. Basically, they set up and still have set up what are called peace camps. Now, a spokesman for the Khartoum government said of the peace camps that we have that these quote-unquote ex-savages are now kept under control. What is he talking about? If you look at these peace camps, they're basically concentration camps. And they set up landmines all around there where they've destroyed the people's way of life. And then they go in and they, quote-unquote, re-educate them. That's the Arabicize and Islamicize, are the ones that are already bending down to Allah. At that particular point, if you look at the before and after pictures, it's very similar to when you look at the westward expansion of the Christian nation of the United States, where you see Indian kids dressed in their normal Indian attire, and then you see them ripped from their families and going to these Christian boarding schools, and they're dressed in, you know, the Christian, you know, westernized clothes with a little Bible in their hand. Well, it's the same thing with what they're doing in Nuba, in the Nuba Mountains, amongst other places. This is a way of destroying people's culture and so on and so forth. So when you hear about a peace deal that's supposed to be taking place in the South, and at the same time, they're at war with the West, and at the same time, they're carrying out genocidal wars also in the Nuba Mountains, it's clear that this type of government that sets up its own modern-day concentration camps is not about a peace in any ways. So they often try to convert and hypnotize the young males into this kind of Islamic jihadist mode, because their whole model is kill a slave with a slave. So after you've hypnotized them for years, and now he's all in this whole, you know, Islamic jihadist mindset, then you use him, if possible, to go and kill some of his own cousins. This is how these clowns are operating. So when you see that the world governments and their corporate henchmen are basically in cahoots with this, it puts into perspective that when they're using terms like peace deals and peace agreements, and you see slime balls like a colon cancer pile over there trying to get them to push through legislation, this is just basically the art of deception and camouflage that get people to believe that quote-unquote progress is being made, in the same way that they try to push the illusion in Iraq that progress under the vote is being made, when at the same time corporate capital genocide is marching full steam ahead.
This is difficult to describe, brothers and sisters, because I'm looking at they just can't. Now look, Tracy gave you some of the very specific dynamics that are going on in the country. But here I want to talk about this United Nations report that Kofi Annan asked the commission to produce this report. All right, explain what's going on in the country and tell us what's happening. Well, they go on and this commission studies the details of human rights violations and war crimes. But then they say that, well, some may have acted with genocidal intention. But there's only one problem, brothers and sisters. Tracy, you correct me right now if I'm wrong. Way over 100,000 people are already dead. Now that's genocide. It doesn't matter about intention. This is slimy, sick stuff. I don't get it. Because I'll tell you what I don't understand, Tracy. I don't understand why the United States is running interference for the Khartoum regime. I don't get.
Well, part of the reason they're doing it is because, you know, quietness is kept. Sam and a lot of his networks have more dealings than what one may normally believe. See, all of these regimes and stuff basically agree on a certain thing. One, that they all want to be the head honcho in charge or get into, you know, different levers of power and stuff like that. And that's going to automatically create a certain conflict amongst each other where they're competing, you know, small would-be capitalist, you know, nations, developing capitalist nations, privatizers in general and stuff like that. But at the same time, there's an unwritten, like, agreement that they all have to keep their dispossessed down. So you have a situation where, let's just take a place like California. Many people probably don't know that in the state of California, there is large investments from the state of California that go directly to the Khartoum government. So there's, I can't say it's a conflict of interest. It's just the way these things are dealt with. I'm going to go into this more later. But next, let's let
Hold on, Trace. Let me just... The point that I wanted to finish, though, and thank you for that, is that this silly game over whether or not, by the UN, they commission people to come up with answers, and they come up with this namby-pamby garbage. Well, I tell you what, it reminds me of how the UN failed to intervene in time to save lives in Rwanda. except that this has been more drawn out, so there's less of an excuse. In Rwanda, 1 million Tutsi and moderate Hutu were killed within the space of about 100 days. But the UN had been warned, Clinton had been warned, and Clinton openly stated, we have no strategic interest in that part of the Africa. Read, they ain't got no oil. They ain't got no gold. They ain't got nothing we need. I don't care what happened to them. But the UN clearly, you know, peace, all that, had the opportunity and the responsibility to intervene. They knew what was happening. It was unfolding, was getting ugly, and it was time to step in, if at all possible, and try to stop this tragedy from occurring. And what we see here in Sudan is these fools just letting this stuff happen. Well, that's what I see. By the way, absolutely correct on the money. There are people who are now calling for divestment from that particular economic, you know. Well, here's what it says. Erase the Darfur bloodstain from California pensions. So there are people that are talking about divesting. In fact, it's Barbara Lee here.
Well,
in
see,
this
you
case.
You have the California pensions that basically has millions of dollars through the whole pension fund that's set up that goes to the Khartoum government. That they use in various ways, in the same way that they get all of these oil revenues, and you have the Chinese, the Malaysian government, and all of them basically making wartime agreements with the Khartoum government. So many of these guys, like Boy George, Colin Powell, they knew that these other guys already had their deal set in Khartoum. So there so you have Chevron, who's already found oil in places like the Nuba Mountain, upset because at one time they couldn't actively go directly in there because of, you know, the relationships and because of the pressure by you know, black people about dealing with the Khartoum government. But in the meantime, they're seeing France, meaning the corporations, and other they're seeing France's corporations and Canadian-based corporations like Talzeman have all these deals struck. So they want to get in there, and they know that they're not concerned about the plight of the people. So as long as they can put on the facade that things are "quote unquote" in progress, then they're willing to
make win the patience of the people.
Right. So next, Booker talks about the rebel leader Garang and how he fits into the picture now that the agreement has been peace agreement, right? Has been outlined, and what this means for the Darfur region. So let's see what they have to say. Check this out.
John Garang will become a vice president in this new national government, this government of national unity. The southern people, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement and Liberation Army, which John Garang heads, will become integrated into this new unity government. They have an arrangement favoring the government in certain central administration roles. The South will have its own administration, and they'll share almost evenly responsibility for three regions bordering the South or in between the South and the North. They're going to share oil wealth. Islamic law is going to be constrained to the north, and in the instance of Khartoum itself, that'll be determined later by an elected assembly. John Garang has made, and the SPLM has made a decision that agreeing to this six-year political solution during which they would try to have autonomy and a unified state would be better than continuing to pursue a violent conflict. And at the end of these 6 years, Southern Sudanese will have an opportunity to vote as to whether they want to secede or whether they want to remain part of a unified Sudan. There are certainly at least two ways to look at it. Some would argue that this agreement augurs well for a peace agreement in Darfur by changing the composition of the central government in Khartoum beginning in 6 months. You have a different government to negotiate with the Darfurian rebels and to end the kind of violence going on in Darfur. That assumes that this agreement will be implemented as planned and that the SPLM will be able to forcefully assert itself on issues in Darfur. On the other hand, I think it can be said that you have to look at the facts on the ground in Darfur. There's been a buildup of the Sudanese military. Conditions have continued to worsen. The World Food Program has suspended food deliveries. Save the Children has pulled out of the Darfur region. And so the government clearly may be using the diplomacy and peace agreement with the South in order to concentrate its forces and its attentions in Darfur, with the intention of defeating this rebellion by continuing to decimate these civilian populations. So it's this contradiction that's at the core of yesterday's signing agreement. And I think it was rather unseemly, in fact, that Secretary Powell was there, the United States having said that the genocide occurring in Sudan and that the government is responsible. It seems inappropriate then that they would be supporting that very government in this signing ceremony, even if there's clearly a need for the international community to support this effort to give Southerners self-determination.
Okay, now basically what he's going on, now John Garang to me in some ways is kind of like a Colin Powell in a sense, because at one time he used to be a fighter for the Arabs, those people who considered themselves Arabs. And basically all it is that when the Nubian civilization was destroyed by the Arab raiders and invaders, the Christopher Columbus's with a turban on, basically you had a situation where regions of the country that had been engulfed by the Christopher Columbus's with turbans went up the behind of, you know, a lot of these at one time Nubians, at one time black folks, and had them screaming out Allah in Arab. So now they're Allah Islam! And now they're kind of these Afro-Arab fanatic types that want to carry on this kind of Islamic Arabian peninsula imagery. They insist on calling the Sudan, which means, Sudan means land of the blacks. And that's how the Arabs called it. That's this Arabic name. But, you know, they're conquerors. And just like all conquerors, they basically want to occupy and control the mode. They want Arab being the dominant language. Now, even though the majority of the people in the Sudan do not consider themselves Arab, the Khartoum government still considers the Sudan part of the Arab world. In other words, part of the Middle East, even though it's in the African continent, and even though the people who designate themselves as Arabs are the minority. Now, if white people in South Africa were saying this is a white country, then it'd be seen as what it really is.
Racist.
But somehow, people have this kind of mysticism going on. And part of it is, as I explained before on the earlier Sudan shows, is that most of us here in America are like New World Africans. We're part of the New World. We were bought through the transatlantic slave trade. You know, we have a direct connection with the Christian European slave trade. But often, since many... I don't want to get too harsh, but since many types of people, for one reason or another, when they talk about the African Holocaust and the slave trade, they compartmentalize it just to the transatlantic slave trade. And they leave out the Arab, Islamic, Mideast slave trade. You can't even explain the transatlantic slave trade without explaining the Arab-Islamic slave trade. civilizations were destroyed during the Arab Islamic conquest, just like the transatlantic.
Right.
It just primarily, not completely, but primarily had its most firmest grip in other regions of Africa, the northern part, you know, where we know like Morocco and Libya, Egypt, after Egypt was conquered, then Nubia was destroyed. Nubia was a civilization that existed before there was an Islam, Christian, or Hebron. And it existed all the way up to the period of the Arab Islamic slave conquest. So at that point, Nubia ceased to exist, and Sudan, as the Arab, the conquerors were calling it, became into play. So we had to keep things in certain focus. Now, John Garang, he was working with the Arab governments that were in charge at one time. When there was a rebellion in the South, he then went to the South. Now, it could just be straight up opportunism. He, you know, actually he is from the South, but he was just collaborating with the Arab-dominated government, and he could have seen an opportunity for him to make a play. What's interesting that hardly ever gets brought out was that during his reign as being basically a Uncle Tom Colin Powell for the Arab regime, he got schooling in Fort Benning, Georgia. So this helps show that the so-called Arab government that has problems, so-called, with the American Empire has had some nice, interesting, cordial relationships. And a reason why I bring this up is that, once again, you have a society that does have many different people. You know, you have the Furs, you have the Dinkas, you have the Nubas, so on and so forth. And if you had a sane type of rational society, those people could primarily just get along because they don't really have that much issue with them. And there's an incredible amount of land mass in Sudan. It's the largest, I'm talking about per acre, country in the African continent. So there's room for people. But you basically have a bunch of privatizers, Arab privatizers, who want privatized control and ownership. So they have to marginalize people, especially since they're the minority, to maintain their hegemony of power. So they go through extreme means to do this. They use food as weapon. They use ethnic identity as weapon, religion as weapon, etc., etc. So this helps create the furor that's taking place. And now you have a situation where in 2001, the Sudan made in revenue $580 million off of its oil revenue. 60% of it went straight to the military. And what did they purchase? Foreign weapons from primarily the Soviet Union. They're buying you know, various fighter jets. Russia. So they're buying these weapons from Russia and just going amok with them. It's Talisman. This is you know, one of these energy companies. This is the Canadian-based one. They basically spend about $1 million a day. They pay $1 million a day with their deals to the Khartoum government. This same government spends about $1 million a day for its particular wars. So they're at war basically with the whole country. You have conflict in the north, which is where they are. You have a north-north divide because, as I mentioned before in the previous Sudan episodes, they fired around 20,000 people, just got their little henchmen in power, you know, and all of that, got rid of all of these particular people who were professors who didn't, you know, go along with their particular orthodoxy, slashed away the unions, et cetera, et cetera. They're at war in the Nuba Mountains committing genocide. They're at war in the western part in Darfur committing genocide. They were at a protracted war, which basically they're buying time to go back again with the South. This is what you this is the results of what you have when you have kind of a theocratic government that uses its religion to decimate populations and is truly under the mindset that they are superior to other people because someone stuck a penis up their behind and had them screaming out Allah and Muhammad. Now, to show you how sick this is in a historical sense, a simple question. What does, let's say, Stern Gang, the Zionist organization, you know, popular around the 1930s, Israeli Zionist organization. What does Stern Gang, what is Henry Ford, the kind of Christian Zionist, you know, the automobile maker who wrote the book International Jew and all of that type of rhetoric, and what does Hassan al-Banna, who was the originator of the Muslim Brotherhood and this whole concept that, you know, back in the 30s that places in the Middle East were becoming too influenced by the West and they needed an Islamicization process to take place and so on and so forth. What do all three of these diverse and often at loggerheads ideologies have in common? The answer? Adolf Hitler. All three were admirers of Adolf Hitler. All three, including al-Banna, offered their services to Hitler. Now, Henry Ford, as we all know, and anyone who reads the book International Jew, was an admirer of Hitler. Hitler was an admirer of him. He kept a large picture of him in his antechamber.
He gave Ford the Iron Cross.
Gave him the Iron Cross, which is in the book International Jew. He had some of his representatives give it to him. He allowed a number of his factories to keep on going, making Nazi war machinery, et cetera, during the war. Then you have, of course, Stern Gang, which offered their services to Hitler. And this is the Israeli Zionist organization. Got their little groove on, so on and so forth. Even though they knew Hitler was exterminating their own country people.
I know this sounds a bit extreme, but there's a book called Eichmann in Jerusalem, which outlines the facts that Tracy is sharing with you right now.
And Hassan al-Banna also wrote to Hitler and offered his services and told him that if they came into Egypt, which is where he originated from, modern Egypt, that him and his brotherhood would be out there in force and support. Now, of course, one would say, wait a minute now. You know, you got Arabs trying to make an alignment with the Nazis. You have Jews trying to make, this don't make no sense. That's what happens when you are overly nationalistic in this kind of ideological framework of thinking that you are chosen and you have some kind of superior edge because of your religion or what have you. You get twisted, just completely twisted out of any form of humanity whatsoever. So when you see these little Islams in Khartoum or defenders of these Khartoum government and trying to pretend that somehow just the indigenous and black people in general in the Sudan are somehow bringing it upon themselves, and you got people who have a lineage. These people in the NIF, many of these guys have lineage in this whole Muslim Brotherhood type stuff because it this kind of spread throughout the whole region. Of course, Egypt is right next to the Sudan. And openly talk about this lineage of solidarity with the Muslim Brotherhood and all of that type of stuff. When you got people offering your services to Hitler, you're the savage. You're the heathen. You're the devil worshiper. Don't talk about some Nubian, some Nuba up in the mountains who ain't harming nobody, and you up there cutting deals with Adolf. That's your lineage, and you're talking about him being some kind of savage. Whose ideology is causing the real conflict on this earth?
Now, you know, part of what the difficulty we have here is what Tracy is describing in some detail when he was talking about those people of the mountains, people of the Southwest and the South, is the national question. See, people very often evolve from tribes into nations. But capitalism does not allow the natural development of people from one phase, let's say a tribe, to the next.
And also, what has happened to the African continent in many regions? See, many of these people were actually what you call this Nubians and stuff. With the Arab Islamic invasion and destruction of Nubia, many of the people became isolated and tribalized over years because, you know, Nubia was right on par with Egypt as a commit. And actually, it was established before the first pharaonic lineage was in Nubia. There are more pyramids in Nubia than there is in Egypt. Many of the founders of Egypt actually came from Nubia. Men, scorpion, etc., etc. What happened was the destruction of that civilization and then the fierce slave trade that started to happen in the region that was basically...
You're talking about 700 AD or you're talking about right after the collapse of the Egyptian Empire?
I'm talking about after the collapse of the Nubian Empire.
Okay.
Because, see, the Nubian Empire kept on going. See, the last Egyptian Empire, well, I mean, when they had more or less their autonomy, was basically around the 25th dynasty, you know, which is, you know, the Kushite kings and stuff like
that. What year is that, John?
Well, that's, this is before
Cleopatra. The Roman Empire, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. See, Alexander came crashing in later, you know, 333
right, so
BC.
Followed by the Greek Empire.
Right. So that's when they basically lost their autonomy. And then you had, of course, the Roman Empire, then the Turkish, and so on and so forth. The Arabs were just the last one to conquer. They weren't indigenous to the region. Actually, the Arabs had disdain for the region. They're the ones who stripped the pyramids of its limestone to use as moss. They sold and broke up the mummies and used them as firewood because they had no historical connection to it at all. So this type of disdain, you know, and this attitude is a typical of any kind of or most conquering nations. Now, because there's Egyptology, it's recognized as an important world civilization. Of course, now many of them claim it, and, you know, and have seminars and so on and so forth.
But mostly make money off of it, I can see.
Yeah, yeah. So
tourist industry.
Right. So this is in part what's going on. But next, let's go to Booker as he talks about how Colin Cancer Powell has backed off the claim that Sudan's government is committing genocide. And let's see how things are metamorphizing. Check it out.
This is the problem with the administration's Sudan policy. That decision to call this a genocide came in response to widespread civic pressure here in the United States from a very eclectic and broad coalition of forces in this country. But, you know, mainly because of the facts on the ground. The State Department undertook a comprehensive study interviewing Sudanese, Darfurian refugees in Chad, etc. And finally forced to acknowledge that what's occurring does need the legal definition of the 1948 Convention on Genocide. At the same time, when Paul acknowledged that at the very hearing in the Senate, he said, but no further action is required on the part of the United States. So in the past, in the Clinton administration, you had an effort to of denial, to refuse to say genocide for fear that that would require the U.S. to act. Now with the Bush administration, you have a willingness to call it genocide, and at the same time saying that no action is required, as if this genocide in Africa is somehow acceptable.
So once again, this kind of shows how sick this is. And basically what's going on is the influence of dollars and so on and so forth. Let me make something real clear. You know, when the Khartoum government is acting like, you know, it has been at loggerheads with the West and all of that type of stuff, a lot of this type of stuff is a facade, because most people don't know that Boy George invited the Sudanese officials to his State of the Union address in 2004. The only reason why it was quietly kind of just pushed away and withdrawn was because a Darfur crisis just got too hot. Now, what the hell is Boy George if they're really quote-unquote at loggerheads and all that? This is about oil.
Invite them.
Yeah. They're on the same team. Look, Boy George has his disposables that he needs to get rid of. You know, the Negroes, the traditional, you know, disposables. Now, Arabs, you know, who have, you know, an identity issue going on, you know, in the whole war on terrorism type stuff. Latinos when it comes to immigration and exploitation of their labor, etc. You got, of course, the Khartoum government that has its disposables. And that's primarily black people, whether they're Muslim or not. See, as I mentioned before, you always had the Khartoum government complaint. Like when there was a lot of dissettlement in the region throughout the Sudan because of their genocidal wars, and many people had, black people had migrated into regions of Khartoum, you started having the president of Khartoum complain that these black people are quote unquote polluting unquote the character of the Arab state of Khartoum. So when you have this sick type of basically Nazi mentality, you can see how these people actually think that because they had some Arab slaver, pumped them up the behind and had them squeal out Muhammad, that they're somehow better than just the regular old black folks. Now, also, the Khartoum regime is basically, you know, like in 2003, received $7 million in an economic support fund. Now, we know also what they're using this for. But now, if Washington provides the grant, which is to quote-unquote help foreign allies, now they're an ally, and they are. They are an ally to the U.S. empire. It'll be boosted up to $20 million. So, what I'm trying to say and do is break some people away from these kind of superficial arguments that people often find themselves in, and realize that there is market privatized capital network at work. And the masses of people always find themselves on the bottom end of that.
And the front for that capital, in this case, is Islam. Just understand that, because that's all it ever is. It always comes back to the economics. I need to make this point briefly, and that is that, believe it or not, you see, in Sudan, the Sudan had the largest communist party in black Africa. About 300,000 members. Now, at one point, I'd like to hear, you know, exactly what happened as this, but I can tell you pretty much what did happen. When the Soviet Union collapsed, all over the third world, political parties that had claimed solidarity with the Soviet Union, that had claimed to be socialists or communists, slowly disintegrated because I guess they needed that little help they were getting from Russia. That help, that was over. No more aid from the Soviet Union. Not a quarter. Now, this, on a certain level, one might say, well, you know what? That means that they weren't real because they couldn't stand alone. And that's partially true. If a party can only exist at the behest of a party, a foreign party outside of their own borders, that doesn't say much for them. But when a party was built on that basis and leaning on the Soviet Union, I want you to look at it like that chair move that Rashid Williams puts on Shaq. Shaq started putting that 370 pounds back on him and leaning back, and then all of a sudden, Rashid would just get out the way. And Shaq stumbles, loses the ball, fouls, whatever. It's a similar dynamic. Just think.
Now next, Booker talks about the whole, well, let's go into how to further highlight the need for black conscious people and other conscious people to rely on themselves for their own self-determination. The UN now says no genocide in Darfur. Now, Edward Montimer, who is the director of communication to the UN general, you know, Kofi Annan, he talks about this new recognition by the UN that there ain't no real there's no real genocide going on, followed by Booker, who challenged that a little bit. So let's check this out.
It finds that the government and its Janjaweed auxiliaries are responsible for an appalling series of crimes against civilians in Darfur, ostensibly against the rebel movement, but in most cases there probably were no rebels anywhere near when these people were being raped, robbed, driven out of their homes, killed in a number of cases, as you say. And even when there were rebels, the use of force was totally disproportionate. So they say this probably amounts to war crimes and crimes against humanity. They were asked to say whether it constituted genocide. They say there is one item missing for that, which is it's not clear that the motivation was to destroy an ethnic group. It does appear that the government was basically concerned to clear out the area where these rebels might find support, although, as you mentioned, it does say that individual government officials may have had genocidal intent, but it says that could only be established on a case-by-case basis by a competent court. They've established a list of the people they believe to be responsible for these crimes, and they have given that in a sealed file to the Secretary General with a request that it only be turned over to a competent prosecutor. And as you said, the body that they think would be competent to conduct such trials and prosecutions is the International Criminal Court. So the ball is, so to speak, now in the court of the Security Council. They have the power under the statute of the court to refer any case to it, and they will have to decide whether that is the right thing to do.
I have to reject the conclusion of the report with regard to the issue of genocide. This is the weakest and almost bizarre part of the report. Because they're finding that there's no government policy of genocide is literally based on three anecdotal examples that they list in the report that have nothing to do with governmental intent. In a way, they're hiding behind this issue because, of course, intent is often the most difficult item to prove. A genocide is constituted of two elements, the mental element, the intent to destroy in whole or in part a racial, national, ethnic, or religious group, and then the physical element, which are the actual acts of violence, the killing, the raping, the other sexual crimes, the destruction of home,
property, livelihood, creating conditions designed to bring about the destruction in whole or in part of particular groups. Now, the report provides ample evidence of all the physical acts of genocide that have resulted in as many as 400,000 people being killed over the past 2 years, 2 million homeless, internally displaced, 200,000 across the border in Chad and refugee camps. And it continues, and the report acknowledges these atrocities continue throughout the period of the investigation. Just last week, there were more than 20 aerial bombardments of villages that the African Union Observer Mission on the ground has noted. In investigating one of these bombings, the African Union troops were fired upon. So this genocide continues. The report simply fails to acknowledge government intent, and the intent is clear in documentary evidence that's available. The report notes that the government refused to provide and refused to cooperate in providing documents that they had promised to provide regarding aircraft and helicopter engagement in Darfur, as well as other documents that Human Rights Watch, for example, has released that provide documentary evidence. But then there's also, legal precedence has it that you can infer intent through the general context or circumstances of the perpetration of these culpable acts when they're systematically directed against a group. And clearly for the last 2 years, the government has used genocide as a methodology of counterinsurgency. The report is mixing intent with motive, even though it claims to make a distinction, it fails to do so. And that's the biggest problem.
Okay, now, you know what? This is not something to be playing with here. This is where one has to wonder, how long are we going to continue to play games with this United Nations? The United Nations is a den of thieves. A den of thieves. That's what it is. There is no hope after in salvaging or reforming the United Nations. After the United Nations was utilized like a $2 whore in the war against Iraq, the first one. Once that happened, it should have become clear, as the Soviet Union was declining before and crumbling and disintegrating before our very eyes, the United Nations was no longer an instrument that in any way could forestall peace. Now, when you have officials from the United Nations get up and split hairs about whether or not 400,000, I thought it was 100,000, dead people constitute genocide. This is not a joke here. I spit in their face and on their graves. I'm through.
And if I come across any of them, I'll be spitting out more than this spit. This is just how capitalists operate. This is their morality. You have a situation where the proven reserves in Sudan is 635 million barrels. Once you put that in perspective, you can see how this chaos has been going on in various corporations and governments have been looking the other way. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned before, the Canadian-based Talisman Energy, who was one of the first multinational companies to go into the whole Sudanese oil exploitation game, paying them in royalties $1 million a day, have been looked on and upon with envy by the various Western powers. And Human Rights has talked about how the government of Sudan, amongst other things, has used oil and its oil infrastructure to support its military action. And as I said before, the Sudanese government is basically dislodging indigenous people off of their land and stuff, in part so they can have no claim to those particular regions. So they use their religion and other stuff. And what's sick about it is that you often see people who are quote unquote progressive about imperial expansion on the Iraq question or the Palestinian question, but just get all befuddled intentionally, especially quite often if they're Muslim, on the Sudanese question. It just shows how sick and how degenerate things are in many ways in this particular society. Now, as one person or people have outlined, when people have challenged these various companies to divest, they've always made excuses about how there's no need to, and like PetroChina said that they weren't going to divest because, quote, there's no reason why we should, unquote. Now, of course, this Chinese company in which BP bought $578 million of stake 12 months ago, they claim is not active in Sudan, but of course they got parent connections and all of this. In other words, they're all playing the same type of games that when you challenge Nike about what it's doing in Indonesia or some place like that, they say we're not directly over there, but basically they have people who are their contractors and are subsidizing this type of, you know, sweatshop madness that is taking place over there. So all of these people are putting profit over human life. That's what it's all about for them. And for the Sudanese government, it's also part of their way of life. Now, when they talk about there's no clear-cut evidence about genocide in the Darfur, along with that just being bogus, they're intentionally ignoring the concentration camps and genocide that are taking place in the Nuba Mountains. It's taking place right at this moment and has been for decades, and they know it. They count on you not knowing it. And as long as you don't know it, they'll just play it off as these people are being massacred away. That's how sick the world is. And that's how sick these ideologies play themselves out when you let them in their particular modes of production. Now, next, Edwin Montimer, you know, the advisor to Kofi Annan, claims he doesn't want to go back and forth with Sally Booker on the genocide issue. So all of a sudden he's impatient about going back and forth about something as crucial as that. Now let me just say something before this. This ain't about the UN. We're not getting salvation from the UN. We're not getting salvation from some liberals or some hypnotist or some peace activist. Our own salvation is going to have to be formed by our own class consciousness, human rights perspective, and collaboration with like-minded people to put these dogs, these devil worshipers, out of existence wherever they reside. So bringing this whole stuff up about the UN is not looking for the UN to do the right thing. This is just exposing how savage and barbaric and how interlinked they are with the rest of these savages. Check it out.
I didn't want to get into an argument with Sally about this, and I think almost we're falling into the trap of the Sudanese government if we do that. I mean, they started out trying to claim this report as some kind of victory because it doesn't say that they're guilty of genocide. But then I think once the full text of the report was published, they completely changed tack. He started saying that it was unfair, biased, and so on and so forth. The report says clearly that the crimes that have been committed may be no less serious and heinous than genocide. It says, as Sally mentioned, that they are continuing and that they must be stopped, that it is urgent to take action. So let's focus on taking the action, and if we get, as I hope we will, if we get to a competent court and to drawing up indictments against these people, then I think it would be for the prosecutor to decide whether to include genocide in the indictment. But the main thing is to take action, to bring these people to justice, and to stop what is happening and is continuing to happen in Darfur right now.
The problem with taking action is another weakness of the report. The only action they refer to is the referring this investigation and the issue of accountability to the International Criminal Court, which we fully support and oppose the Bush administration's opposition. The problem, however, is that does nothing to protect the civilians on the ground in Darfur who continue to die every day. Numbers estimated between 10,000 to 30,000 per month. The report in its first conclusion says that the people in Darfur need to be protected, yet it doesn't recommend a Chapter 7 mandate for an international intervention to protect civilians and enforce, not observe, enforce the ceasefire. The African Union troops on the ground acknowledge they are not enough, they don't have the right mandate, and the international community is just dumping this problem on the African Union, which doesn't have the capacity to solve it. And so again, the international community is not living up to its own obligations. And I would argue that this is in part because they refuse to recognize this genocide. You know, yes, they're willing to say it's war crimes, crimes against humanity, but because they've set up this public perception that somehow this is a lesser evil, they're not moving for any kind of Security Council resolution calling for a new mandate and an expansion of the force to protect the civilians.
Look, let's not dump this all on this commission. The fact is there's plenty of things that could have been done, and some things have been done, without waiting for this report. The commission was given specific terms of reference, and I think it has fulfilled those. Recommending military intervention or other ways of dealing with things, I think, was not within their competence. Governments in the Security Council have the responsibility to decide how to deal with this crisis. They had that responsibility yesterday, and I think they have it even more sharply today in the light of what the report says.
You know, over a year ago, the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for Sudan, Mukesh Kapila, said, and I quote, "The only difference between Rwanda and Darfur now is the numbers involved. This is more than just a conflict. It's an organized attempt to do away with a group of people." That was the UN's own humanitarian coordinator for Sudan a year ago. We're in agreement about the need for accountability. We're in agreement about the need to stop the violence and the atrocities. Where we differ is that this is genocide. That's why it's important that you call it what it is. Otherwise, there's no point in having an international convention on genocide. There's no point in saying never again, as we did at the 60th anniversary of the Holocaust or the 10th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. And this is why the UN finding has generated such headlines as Sudan exonerated of genocide, etc. Imagine if the commission had acknowledged that, in fact, genocide is taking place. The political and moral obligation and pressure on the UN to finally act and protect civilians would have been far greater. As it is now, they're only talking about a resolution of sanctions.
I think you're doing a poor job as an advocate for human rights. You're emphasizing the one point in this report that you don't like, and you were saying that these are the headlines, but you're contributing to those headlines. Why don't you emphasize the things that you do like, that you agree about, and surely the need for action is the most important point.
As human rights advocates, we have an obligation to acknowledge genocide when it's occurring. It is a unique
Okay, let's say, whether it's genocide or not, are you going to wait until we agree on whether it's genocide before you do anything about it? Wouldn't it be more sensible to get on with it?
Well, that is what we've been trying to
do. Okay, then let's not waste time on this argument.
Which the United Nations has failed to do. As I said, they've dumped this on the African Union, and they've been unwilling to bring the necessary force to bear. They're only talking about sanctions.
Well, now we're talking about something which is urgent and immediate.
You've been talking about sanctions. The past three UN Security Council resolutions have been getting weaker and weaker. The last
that's where you should be concentrating your fire, surely, on the members of the Security Council. I think we agree that more urgent action is needed by the Security Council. And, that means putting pressure on the governments represented in the Security Council to do something.
When I catch up with some of these clowns, I'll be the first to say I'm going to be putting their lights out. Because this is some sick stuff. And all these apologists, let me make this real clear. When they talk about the Khartoum government is not committing genocide and all of that type of stuff, and you know all this madness going on, and how this guy admits that they can't even inspect certain areas because they've been blocked off by the Khartoum government. Meanwhile, everyone's seeing them bomb up civilian areas. This is that technique, it's a counterinsurgency technique of draining the sea of its population. So these little devil worshippers end up attacking the civilian population. They use the little girls as incubators to quote-unquote make Arabic kids, you know, because this whole lineage thing, if it's an Arab quote-unquote father and all of this nonsense. This is some sick stuff. Meanwhile, starting on April 27, 1993, a fatwa, or Islamic decree, was issued at an Islamic conference in El Obeid, in the north of the Nuba region. This was to legitimize the holy war against the Nubas. The conference was attended by the little Muslim imams and leading Sufi Sikhs and religious teachers, you know, knee benders with guns. And it was held, of course, with the full knowledge and blessing of the government, who, of course, was arming these people. Its decree declared that the Nubas were, quote, infidels deserving of death, unquote. This is the same region, as I've been mentioned before, that they got concentration camps. I talked earlier about the guy bragging about them having 91 concentration camps, you know, and de-savaging them by, you know, slapping Islam on them and stuff. The rest just do away with them. This is the mode of operation that these clowns have been operating in. Now, since the early 70s, you've had degradation of land in the Nuba areas and stuff because of the whole, for one instance, it was called the Habla scheme. Now, this was a mechanized farming style that didn't correspond with the type of topsoil and land in the region that the Nubas had been operating in their particular way, in harmony with the land for time immemorial. So they ended up destroying large patches of the region and stuff, yet they're displacing people with their own personal privatized economic incentives, oil and otherwise. So for these clowns, or for this clown, Mortimer, he's the clown, to leave out these kind of historical facts that have been taking place not just in Darfur shows how cynical this whole process is. And basically, the whole game is just to try to present us as like we're crazy. You know, it's like black folks are crazy wherever we are. So you look over at the Ivory Coast and you see all these black folks throwing out the French, and you don't get any real historical perspective on it. It's like we're going crazy. Then you look over at Zimbabwe or South Africa, where black people are throwing out the white farm owners who control 80% of the land. And once again, it looks like we're crazy again. Then you see black folks revolting in the Nuba Mountains, in the southern part, in Darfur. And it looks like we're crazy again. And then, of course, you look over at America, and it really looks like we're crazy here. In other words, the whole thing is designed by the whole gumpification measure to make us look like we're just a psychopathic people. Wherever we are, we're in chaos, and it's by our own doing.
Blood, you just, look at, that's it. That's it, that's it, that's it. And you know what? It won't go on either, because they're running out of fools. That's why this debate was so intense. That's why, if you notice, Mr. Mortimer was cutting off his opponent. He didn't want that man to be able to explain the position. He's a charlatan, a sophist, a professional liar, a bureaucrat, a traitor to humanity. Faking! as the Prince of Peace. He ought to be ashamed of his damn self, but I think we're getting.
And when you see that the Nuba issue was not on the agenda of the peace agenda concerning the North and South, meaning the Khartoum government in the South, and when you see that the Darfur crisis was not on the agenda, one has to realize that basically the UN is just basically being a moderator for the corporate governments throughout the world.
That's exactly
They're basically just trying to moderate the situation so all of them can exploit. It's kind of like the Pope, who back in the day when the European nations were fighting over the African continent, he served as basically the moderator.
A referee.
Yeah, of who gets what part of Africa. So, okay, Germans, you get this part. Belgians, you get the Congo, you know, et cetera, et cetera. French, you get this, you know, right down the line. Now what you have is the UN, in a sense, playing that role. Because genocide is running amok. Not just in the Sudan, but in the Congo, et cetera, et cetera. As I mentioned last week, here you have Mark Thatcher just get caught not too long ago trying to perform a coup. Here's Margaret Thatcher's son.
Son, right.
Get caught with a bunch of thugs trying to perform
weapons and everything.
Right in the southern region. They were trying to turn the southern region of Africa in the same type of chaos that the Congo is now, so these merchants of death can exploit the minerals and stuff out of it. He gets caught, slapped on the wrist, and he's let go free. He still has his head attached to his shoulders. What I'm saying, in essence, is that these devil worshippers at the Khartoum government, you know, who had someone plunge their penis up their behind, and now they squeal out Islam, they can't keep their head on their shoulders. These little spokesmen for the UN and defenders of the UN, you can't keep your head on your shoulders. These clowns like Colon Cancer Powell and these defenders of these regimes and corporations for the U.S. Empire, for Malaysia, for China, and all these other pimps that are running amok in the Sudan, nah, y'all can't keep your head on your shoulders.
Now, hold on, Tracy. There's a conflict of interest in what you're saying, given that you have set up the head coughing business. You coming on pretty hard, baby.
It is a conflict of interest, since it is my business that let's just say that I'm also, I admit, an active participant in helping promote my business. I don't just build the coffins. I help produce the heads that wind up in those coffins. Hold on a sec. Alright, you know what time it is now. Shameless file time. And right now, we're going to bust into the recent election that took place in Iraq. You know, it had a neocon henchman, Richard Pearl. He was on Fox News talking about the high turnout at the Iraqi election. Let's see what this really means. I know what it means. Martial law, democracy. But let's check out what Richard Pearl has to say. Check it out.
You thought it was me. You thought it was me.
Unofficial number, but it looks like it's $2.
You thought it was me. They fake an identity.
an extraordinary commentary on the desire of people everywhere, even when threatened, even when intimidated, even when risking their lives, to vote for a government of their own choice. It's a wonderful day, not only for democracy, not only for the people of Iraq, but for everyone in the world who desires to be free from despotism.
But are you surprised? I mean, and be honest here, did you think it was going to be this high a turnout?
Well, I'm impressed with the turnout. It was impossible to estimate how the threats to kill people going to vote, to kill them at the polling places, to kill them after the election when it was noted that they had voted. It was impossible to tell how that would affect people, but it is a tremendous commentary on the courage of Iraqis if they have risked their lives to vote. And they have voted in higher numbers than we vote in the safety and security of our own country.
Did you?
Well, sounds very interesting. So I guess what he's telling us is that President Bush's program is a very clearly verifiable success, that lots and lots and lots of people voted. I've heard as high as 62%, according to the corporate media. And therefore, onward and upward, Christian soldier. Welcome to Democracy Iraq. Happy ending for all concerned. Bullshit. Now, let me run it down for you. One, good friend of mine's gave me this article. It says, U.S. encouraged by Vietnam vote. Officials cite 83% of the turnout despite Viet Cong terror. I'm only going to read you a little paragraph here that just lets you see and judge for yourself. It reads, this is from 1967, September the 4th. United States officials were surprised and heartened today at the size of turnout in South Vietnam's presidential election despite a Viet Cong terrorist campaign to disrupt the voting. According to reports from Saigon, 83% of the 5.85 million registered voters cast their ballots yesterday. Many of them risked reprisals threatened by the Viet Cong. If you just take out Vietnam, put in Iraq, take out Viet Cong, and put in insurgents, you got the same warmed over BS today that they was giving us back in 1967, y'all. I still feel the pain because ain't nothing changed. Check this out, y'all. What we got is a situation where, and that's what Tracy and I are relentless. It don't matter if they're Democrat, Republican. It's two parties representing one class. Stop going for that okey-doke. Oh, if we only had the Democrats in there, they do. Oh, yeah? Do you really think so? There's a famous statement, and that is that those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat those defeats. Don't be a political chump going along with this propaganda talking about they helping somebody. We gonna help the Iraqi people have an election. We gonna help the Iraqi people have democracy. We gonna help the Iraqi people enter civilization and all other such madness. You just hold on and let's look. A successful election has long been seen as a keystone in President Johnson's policy of encouraging the growth of constitutional processes in South Vietnam. The election was the culmination of a constitutional development that began in January 1966, to which President Johnson gave his personal commitment when he met Premier Ky and General Thieu, the Chief of State, in Honolulu in February. Let's stop. Take out President Johnson, put in President Bush, or I prefer Boy George myself, and then go ahead and take out General and put you know, the General there and put in Alawi. And what do you have? You got the same jive game. I still feel the pain because ain't nothing changed. When are we going to change? That's what I'm asking our listeners. When are we going to rise above this jive dog and pony show that they're putting on, fooling the American people as if they done some favor for humanity and they done killed over 100,000 innocent people, babies, in Iraq?
What's fascinating in part about some of this is that, you know, when they pulled down Saddam's little statue, they said that there was a great change and that this was indicative of the outpouring of support and of the Iraqi people in their need and quest for freedom. Then we found out that the picture was basically a hack job and that there wasn't nearly as many people out there. Then they moved on from there, and the same corporate media was behind the fact that once Saddam had been caught, that that would once again you would see an outpouring of people who would support the Americans' cause, because after all the great dictator was gone. And that time came and passed, and guess what? The insurgents were still whipping ass. They also said that after his sons were eliminated, the brutal sons, that this was going to be a new day, sunrise on a new day. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this is that there's no reason whatsoever. After the corporate media and their governmental henchmen have lied and been caught time and time again of fabricating evidence, fabricating the whole construct of the war and the reasons for the war, why would any reasonable person give them the benefit of the doubt? Also, when this guy asked Richard Pearl, are you surprised at the turnout? Once again, this was the corporate media playing a game, because they, of course, didn't do any kind of independent investigative reporting or counting themselves, because it's already turned out that when they said that there was about 70% plus people who were coming out to vote, they had to retract on that. It keeps going down each time. There's no telling how many people. Then we recently found out that a large number of people that they kept showing going towards the voting poll actually weren't going towards the voting poll. There were people going back to the town of Fallujah, and they just used that tape to present an image that people were going off to vote. In other words, they are intentionally manipulating this whole situation. Right. So, vote or no vote, why would anyone give them the benefit of the doubt? Now, also to make some things real plain, all the rhetoric about this whole vote and what it's supposed to mean and so on and so forth, you recently had Friedman, who is this individual who, you know, talks about the Iraq situation and what it means and so on and so forth. He recently said that, quote, over Sam's military reach over the region, quote, think of Iraq as a military base with a very large oil reserve underneath. You can't ask for any better than that. This was what was said to Freeman by a Wall Street oil analyst, Fidel Gatsit, G-A-E-I-T. This is what he said. Now, when you have people making these types of statements, it gives you an indication about how sick of what's going on. But next, let's go into some of the talk of the Iraqi candidates and what they are going to, quote unquote, bring to the table.
Candidates?
Check this out.
Show today, we had several candidates. We had Ibrahim al-Jafari, Ahmed Chalabi.
I got to stop right there. Did you hear who she just said? The other day, we just had, earlier on, we had a couple of candidates that, and one of the persons she named was Ahmed Chalabi. Now, how in the hell did Ahmed Chalabi somehow get back in the picture? If that doesn't prove this whole thing is a fraud, and that Chalabi must have been some kind of covert operative, because first they acted like he was on their side and that he was going to help usher in the new democracy, and he was feeding them all this information to basically invade. Then when the invasion didn't go right, they put up this kind of front image that Chalabi was somehow working with the Iranians, and that he was intentionally sabotaged the process with his Iranian collaborators. Now all of a sudden, we find out that Chalabi is one of the candidates that's running for office. And these clowns at Fox News mentioned Chalabi without any blink of an eye, without any irony whatsoever, in their own words.
Earlier on the show today, we had several candidates. We had Ibrahim Al-Jafari, Ahmed Chalabi. From the U.S. standpoint, who are we hoping will lead the country? Who are we hoping will be successful today? Why? And what are some of the concerns we have about the other candidates?
Well, different officials inclined toward different candidates, based in part on whether they've known them and had experience with them. Obviously, the Iraqis are making this choice, and I think much less important than who emerges is the way in which they've emerged. We're committed to supporting the emergence of democratic institutions, and that means setting aside any preferences we might have and recognizing who the...
That's enough. We really ran out of time, so I'm going to make this clear. When you have Chalabi basically aligning back up, so-called, with the regime as if he ever really left, then you know there's some covert operation going on. And basically, Sam is on public relations genocidal mode. What this also has helped do, when the CIA groomed exile Ahmed Chalabi, has gotten back, or not really gotten back, but is also reappears into the picture. At the same time that they were drawing out these elections, this election type of stuff, before telling you who was going to be a candidate for the election, they also drew up incredible broad raging plans to privatize the entire Iraqi economy, including the oil sector. This was before the Iraqi people got a chance to even cast one vote. So if they're doing this at the same time, and it's outside of the decision-making possibility of the Iraqi people, and all the Iraqi people do is get to throw some vote out into the wind for whatever raggedy candidates under control of the U.S. empire, only a dupe would believe, the same type of dupe that believes there's a significant difference between a Democrat and Republican, that this Iraqi election thing is anything other than what it is, an imperial scam.
But at the same time, brothers and sisters, we must say this. We sympathize with the people of Iraq and respect those people who found a way and the courage to go and vote. Remember, 44 people died en route to going to vote. So that wasn't no joke. We understand the impulse to want to vote. Nevertheless, we do not bow to the illusions that people had.
Well, first of all, this is more than just having impulses. This is in part a failure of the Iraqi insurgents, in my interpretation. Because, see, at a certain point, when you have this much control of the region, you have to start putting out your own ideas and programs.
Right.
You have to start outlining your vision of a future. In a way that resonates amongst the people. You have to start setting up clinics where you have health cares and so on and so forth. Basically, the Iraqi insurgents' vision is this: the U.S. out of Iraq. And it's this kind of this, you know, wait for the imam to say whatever. Those with the, no, really, those with the guns, those who are putting their lives out on the line, start to outline your own vision of the world. That's how things are done in this type of guerrilla warfare
situation. But just one thing we got to share.
Because otherwise, the people are just going to get pimped out.
That's true.
Because right now, they're going into a genocidal mode where they're bombing up the population. And it's pretty obvious that the U.S. is saying we can't leave right now because too much would be left intact for the insurgents to be able to operate in. So they're willing to bomb up for the next couple of years and leave basically the region in kind of a Talibanistic type of state. And the only way to counteract that is to grow your insurgencies in a cohesion, military type of visionary fashion.
But that requires a revolutionary party.
That's what I was talking about. It's not, they're not heading that direction.
That's clear
they're not.
And it's sad.
Especially when this type of stuff, votes going on, and all you're doing is shooting at people.
That's right.
But hold on a sec, we just about run out of time. Hold up. That just about wraps things up. It's clear that everything is not as clear as it should be, but it will be when all the dust clears and these savages and devil worshippers are where they belong, underneath the ground. Then everything will be everything. Until the next time, slave mode. Out.
Yo, we about to check.